At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lieutenant Cushing and the Ram Albemarle, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. Lieutenant Cushing and the Ram Albemarle, written by Theodore Roosevelt. God give us peace, not such as lulls to sleep, but sword on thigh and brow with purpose knit, and let our ship of state to harbor sweep, her ports all up, her battle lanterns lit, and her leashed thunders gathering for their leap. Lowell. The great Civil War was remarkable in many ways, but in no way more remarkable than for the extraordinary mixture of inventive mechanical genius and of resolute daring shown by the combatants. After the first year, when the contestants had settled down to real fighting, and the preliminary mob work was over, the battles were marked by their extraordinary obstinacy and heavy loss. In no European conflict since the close of the Napoleonic Wars has the fighting been anything like as obstinate and as bloody as was the fighting in our own Civil War. In addition to this fierce and dogged courage, this splendid fighting capacity, the contest also brought out the skilled inventive power of engineer and mechanician in a way that few other contests have ever done. This was especially true of the Navy. The fighting under and against Farragut and his fellow admirals revolutionized naval warfare. The Civil War marks the break between the old style and the new. Terrible encounters took place when the terrible new engines of war were brought into action for the first time, and one of these encounters has given an example which, for heroic daring combined with cool intelligence, is unsurpassed in all time. The Confederates showed the same skill and energy in building their great ironclad rams as the men of the Union did in building the monitors which were so often pitted against them. Both sides, but especially the Confederates, also used stationary torpedoes, and on a number of occasions, torpedo boats likewise. These torpedo boats were sometimes built to go under the water. One such, after repeated failures, was employed by the Confederates, with equal gallantry and success, in sinking a Union sloop of war off Charleston Harbor, the torpedo boat itself going down to the bottom with its victim, all on board being drowned. The other type of torpedo boat was simply a swift, ordinary steam launch, operated above water. It was this last type of boat which Lieutenant W.B. Cushing brought down to Albemarle Sound to use against the great Confederate ram Albemarle. The ram had been built for the purpose of destroying the Union blockading forces. Steaming down river, she had twice attacked the Federal gunboats, and in each case had sunk or disabled one or more of them, with little injury to herself. She had retired up the river again to lie at her wharf and refit. The gunboats had suffered so severely as to make it a certainty that when she came out again, thoroughly fitted to renew the attack, the wooden vessels would be destroyed, and while she was in existence, the Union vessels could not reduce the forts and coast towns. Just at this time, Cushing came down from the north with his swift little torpedo boat, an open launch, with a spar rigged out in front, the torpedo being placed at the end. The crew of the launch consisted of 15 men, Cushing being in command. He not only guided his craft, but himself handled the torpedo by means of two small ropes, one of which put it in place, while the other exploded it. The action of the torpedo was complicated, and it could not have been operated in a time of tremendous excitement save by a man of the utmost nerve and self-command, but Cushing had both. he possessed precisely that combination of reckless courage, presence of mind, and high mental capacity necessary to the man who leads a forlorn hope under peculiarly difficult circumstances. On the night of October 27, 1864, Cushing slipped away from the blockading fleet and steamed up river toward the wharf a dozen miles distant where the great ram lay. The Confederates were watchful to guard against surprise, for they feared lest their foes should try to destroy the ram before she got a chance to come down and attack them again in the Sound. She lay under the guns of a fort, with a regiment of troops ready at a moment's notice to turn out and defend her. Her own guns were kept always clear for action, and she was protected by a great boom of logs thrown out roundabout, of which last defense the Northerners knew nothing. Cushing went upstream with the utmost caution, and by good luck passed, unnoticed, a Confederate lookout below the ram. About midnight he made his assault, steaming quietly on through the black water and feeling his way cautiously toward where he knew the town to be. He finally made out the loom of the Albemarle through the night, and at once drove at her. He was almost upon her before he was discovered. Then the crew and the soldiers on the wharf opened fire, and, at the same moment, he was brought to by the boom, the existence of which he had not known. The rifle balls were singing round him as he stood erect, guiding his launch, and he heard the bustle of the men aboard the ram and the noise of the great guns as they were got ready. Backing off, he again went all steam ahead, and actually surged over the slippery logs of the boom. Meanwhile, on the Albemarle, the sailors were running to quarters, and the soldiers were swarming down to aid in her defense, and the droning bullets came always thicker through the dark night. Cushing still stood upright in his little craft, guiding and controlling her by voice and signal, while in his hands he kept the ropes which led to the torpedo. As the boat slid forward over the boom, he brought the torpedo full against the somber side of the huge ram, and instantly exploded it, almost at the same time that the pivot gun of the ram, loaded with grape, was fired point-blank at him not 10 yards off. At once the ram settled, the launch sinking at the same moment, while Cushing and his men swam for their lives. Most of them sank or were captured, but Cushing reached midstream. Hearing something splashing in the darkness, he swam toward it, and found that it was one of his crew. He went to his rescue, and they kept together for some time, but the sailor's strength gave out, and he finally sank. In the pitch darkness, Cushing could form no idea where he was, and when, chilled through and too exhausted to rise to his feet, he finally reached shore shortly before dawn, he found that he had swum back and landed but a few hundred feet below the sunken ram. All that day he remained within easy musket shot of where his foes were swarming about the fort and the great drowned ironclad. He hardly dared move, and until that afternoon he lay without food and without protection from the heat or venomous insects. Then he managed to slip unobserved into the dense swamp and began to make his way to the fleet. Toward evening he came out on a small stream near a camp of Confederate soldiers. They had moored to the bank a skiff, and with equal strength and daring, he managed to steal this and to paddle downstream. Hour after hour he paddled on through the fading light, and then through the darkness. At last, utterly worn out, he found the squadron and was picked up. At once the ships weighed, and they speedily captured every coast town and fort, for their dreaded enemy was no longer in the way. The fame of Cushing's deed went all over the North, and his name will stand forever among the brightest on the honor roll of the American Navy. End of Lieutenant Cushing and the Ram Albemarle by Theodore Roosevelt. Farragut at Mobile Bay, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. Farragut at Mobile Bay, written by Theodore Roosevelt. Ha, old ship, do they thrill, the brave 200 scars you got in the river wars, that were leeched with clamorous skill, surgery savage and hard, at the Brooklyn Naval Yard? How the guns, as with cheer and shout, our tacklemen hurled them out, brought up in the waterways, as we fired, at the flash, 'twas lightning and black eclipse with a bellowing sound and crash. The Dahlgrens are dumb, dumb are the mortars. Nevermore shall the drum beat to colors and quarters. The great guns are silent. Henry Howard Brownell. During the Civil War, our Navy produced, as it has always produced in every war, scores of capable officers, of brilliant single-ship commanders, of men whose daring courage made them fit leaders in any hazardous enterprise. In this respect, the Union seamen in the Civil War merely lived up to the traditions of their service. In a service with such glorious memories, it was a difficult thing to establish a new record in feats of personal courage or warlike address. Biddle, in the Revolutionary War, fighting his little frigate against a ship of the line until she blew up with all on board, after inflicting severe loss on her huge adversary, Decatur, heading the rush of the boarders in the night attack when they swept the wild Moorish pirates from the decks of their anchored prize, Lawrence, dying with the words on his lips, "Don't give up the ship," and Perry, triumphantly steering his bloody sloop of war to victory with the same words blazoned on his banner. Men like these, and like their fellows, who won glory in desperate conflicts with the regular warships and heavy privateers of England and France, or with the corsairs of the Barbary States, left behind a reputation which was hardly to be dimmed, though it might be emulated, by later feats of mere daring. But vital though daring is, indispensable though desperate personal prowess and readiness to take chances are to the makeup of a fighting navy, other qualities are needed in addition to fit a man for a place among the great sea captains of all time. It was the good fortune of the Navy in the Civil War to produce one admiral of renown, one peer of all the mighty men who have ever waged war on the ocean. Farragut was not only the greatest admiral since Nelson, but, with the sole exception of Nelson, he was as great an admiral as ever sailed the broad or the narrow seas. David Glasgow Farragut was born in Tennessee. He was appointed to the Navy while living in Louisiana, but when the war came, he remained loyal to the Union flag. This puts him in the category of those men who deserved best of their country in the Civil War, the men who were Southern by birth, but who stood loyally by the Union, the men like General Thomas of Virginia, and like Farragut's own flag captain at the Battle of Mobile Bay, Drayton of South Carolina. It was an easy thing in the North to support the Union, and it was a double disgrace to be, like Vallandigham and the Copperheads, against it. And in the South there were a great multitude of men, as honorable as they were brave, who, from the best of motives, went with their states when they seceded, or even advocated secession. But the highest and loftiest patriots, those who deserved best of the whole country, were the men from the South who possessed such heroic courage and such lofty fealty to the high ideal of the Union that they stood by the flag when their fellows deserted it, and unswervingly followed a career devoted to the cause of the whole nation and of the whole people. Among all those who fought in this, the greatest struggle for righteousness which the present century has seen, these men stand preeminent, and among them Farragut stands first. It was his good fortune that by his life he offered an example not only of patriotism, but of highest degree the qualities of courage and daring, of readiness to assume responsibility, and of willingness to run great risks, the qualities without which no commander, however cautious and able, can ever become really great. He possessed also the unwearied capacity for taking thought in advance, which enabled him to prepare for victory before the day of battle came, and he added to this an inexhaustible fertility of resource and presence of mind under no matter what strain. His whole career should be taught every American schoolboy, for when that schoolboy becomes a voter, he should have learned the lesson that the United States, while it ought not to become an overgrown military power, should always have a first-class navy, formidable from the number of its ships, and formidable still more from the excellence of the individual ships and the high character of the officers and men. Farragut saw the War of 1812, in which, though our few frigates and sloops fought some glorious actions, our coasts were blockaded and insulted, and the capital at Washington burned, because our statesmen and our people had been too short-sighted to build a big fighting navy. And Farragut was able to perform his great feats on the Gulf Coast because, when the Civil War broke out, we had a navy which, though too small in point of numbers, was composed of ships as good as any afloat. Another lesson to be learned by a study of his career is that no man in a profession so highly technical as that of the Navy can win a great success unless he has been brought up in and specially trained for that profession, and has devoted his life to the work. This fact was made plainly evident in the desperate hurly-burly of the night battle with the Confederate flotilla below New Orleans, the incidents of this hurly-burly being, perhaps, best described by the officer who, in his report of his own share in it, remarked that all sorts of things happened. Of the Confederate rams there were two, commanded by trained officers formerly in the United States Navy, Lieutenants Kennon and Worley. Both of these men handled their little vessels with remarkable courage, skill, and success, fighting them to the last and inflicting serious and heavy damage upon the Union fleet. The other vessels of the flotilla were commanded by men who had not been in the regular Navy, who were merely Mississippi River captains and the like. These men were, doubtless, naturally as brave as any of the regular officers, but with one or two exceptions, they failed ignobly in the time of trial and showed a fairly startling contrast with the regular naval officers beside or against whom they fought. This is a fact which may well be pondered by the ignorant or unpatriotic people who believe that the United States does not need a navy, or that it can improvise one and improvise officers to handle it whenever the moment of need arises. When a boy, Farragut had sailed as a midshipman on the Essex in her famous cruise to the South Pacific, and lived through the murderous fight in which, after losing 3/5 of her crew, she was captured by 2 British vessels. Step by step he rose in his profession, but never had an opportunity of distinguishing himself until, when he was 60 years old, the Civil War broke out. He was then made flag officer of the Gulf Squadron, and the first success which the Union forces met with in the Southwest was scored by him, when one night he burst the iron chains which the Confederates had stretched across the Mississippi, and stemming the swollen flood with his splendidly handled steam frigates, swept past the forts, sank the rams and gunboats that sought to bar his path, and captured the city of New Orleans. After further exciting service on the Mississippi, service in which he turned a new chapter in the history of naval warfare by showing the possibilities of heavy seagoing vessels when used on great rivers, he again went back to the Gulf, and in the last year of the war was allotted the task of attempting the capture of Mobile, the only important port still left open to the Confederates. In August 1864, Farragut was lying with his fleet off Mobile Bay. For months he had been eating out his heart while undergoing the wearing strain of the blockade, sympathizing, too, with every detail of the doubtful struggle on land. "I get right sick every now and then at the bad news," he once wrote home. And then again, "The victory of the Kearsarge over the Alabama raised me up. I would sooner have fought that fight than any ever fought on the ocean." As for himself, all he wished was a chance to fight, for he had the fighting temperament, and he knew that, in the long run, an enemy can only be beaten by being outfought as well as outmaneuvered. He possessed a splendid self-confidence and scornfully threw aside any idea that he would be defeated, while he utterly refused to be daunted by the rumors of the formidable nature of the defenses against which he was to act. "I mean to be whipped or to whip my enemy, and not to be scared to death," he remarked in speaking of these rumors. The Confederates who held Mobile used all their skill in preparing for defense, and all their courage in making that defense good. The mouth of the bay was protected by 2 fine forts, heavily armed, Morgan and Gaines. The winding channels were filled with torpedoes, and in addition there was a flotilla consisting of 3 gunboats, and above all a big ironclad ram, the Tennessee, one of the most formidable vessels then afloat. She was not fast, but she carried 6 high-powered rifled guns, and her armor was very powerful, while being of light draft, she could take a position where Farragut's deep-sea ships could not get at her. Farragut made his attack with 4 monitors. 2 of them, the Tecumseh and Manhattan, of large size, carrying 15-inch guns, and the other 2, the Winnebago and Chickasaw, smaller and lighter, with 11-inch guns, and the wooden vessels, 14 in number. 7 of these were big sloops of war, of the general type of Farragut's own flagship, the Hartford. She was a screw steamer, but was a full-rigged ship likewise, with 22 9-inch shell guns arranged in broadside, and carrying a crew of 300 men. The other 7 were light gunboats. When Farragut prepared for the assault, he arranged to make the attack with his wooden ships in double column. The 7 most powerful were formed on the right, in line ahead, to engage Fort Morgan, the heaviest of the 2 forts, which had to be passed close inshore to the right. The light vessels were lashed each to the left of one of the heavier ones. By this arrangement, each pair of ships was given a double chance to escape if rendered helpless by a shot in the boiler or other vital part of the machinery. The heaviest ships led in the fighting column, the first place being taken by the Brooklyn and her gunboat consort, while the second position was held by Farragut himself in the Hartford, with the little Metacomet lashed alongside. He waited to deliver the attack until the tide and the wind should be favorable, and made all his preparations with the utmost care and thoughtfulness. Preeminently a man who could inspire affection in others, both the officers and men of the fleet regarded him with fervent loyalty and absolute trust. The attack was made early on the morning of August 5th. Soon after midnight, the weather became hot and calm, and at 3 the admiral learned that a light breeze had sprung up from the quarter he wished, and he at once announced, "Then we will go in this morning." At daybreak he was at breakfast when the word was brought that the ships were all lashed in couples. Turning quietly to his captain, he said, "Well, Drayton, we might as well get under way." And at 6:30 the monitors stood down to their stations, while the column of wooden ships was formed, all with the United States flag hoisted, not only at the peak, but also at every masthead. The 4 monitors, trusting in their iron sides, steamed in between the wooden ships and the fort. Every man in every craft was thrilling with the fierce excitement of battle, but in the minds of most there lurked a vague feeling of unrest over one danger. For their foes who fought in sight, for the forts, the gunboats, and the great ironclad ram, they cared nothing. But all, save the very boldest, were at times awed and rendered uneasy by the fear of the hidden and the unknown. Danger which is great and real, but which is shrouded in mystery, is always very awful, and the ocean veterans dreaded the torpedoes, the mines of death, which lay, they knew not where, thickly scattered through the channels along which they were to thread their way. The tall ships were in fighting trim, with spars housed and canvas furled. The decks were strewn with sawdust, every man was in his place, the guns were ready, and except for the song of the sounding lead, there was silence in the ships as they moved forward through the glorious morning. It was 7 o'clock when the battle began, as the Tecumseh, the leading monitor, fired 2 shots at the fort. In a few minutes Fort Morgan was ablaze with the flash of her guns, and the leading wooden vessels were sending back broadside after broadside. Farragut stood in the port main rigging, and as the smoke increased he gradually climbed higher until he was close by the maintop, where the pilot was stationed for the sake of clearer vision. The captain, fearing lest by one of the accidents of battle the great admiral should lose his footing, sent aloft a man with a lasher, and had a turn or two taken around his body in the shrouds, so that he might not fall if wounded, for the shots were flying thick. At first the ships used only their bow guns, and the Confederate ram, with her great steel rifles, and her 3 consorts, taking station where they could rake the advancing fleet, caused much loss. In 20 minutes after the opening of the fight, the ships of the van were fairly abreast of the fort, their guns leaping and thundering, and under the weight of their terrific fire that of the fort visibly slackened. All was now uproar and slaughter, the smoke drifting off in clouds. The decks were reddened and ghastly with blood, and the wreck of flying splinters drove across them at each discharge. The monitor Tecumseh alone was silent. After firing the first two shots, her commander, Captain Craven, had loaded his two big guns with steel shot, and thus prepared, reserved himself for the Confederate ironclad, which he had set his heart upon taking or destroying single-handed. The two columns of monitors and the wooden ships lashed in pairs were now approaching the narrowest part of the channel, where the torpedoes lay thickest, and the guns of the vessels fairly overbore and quelled the fire from the fort. All was well, provided only the two columns could push straight on without hesitation. But just at this moment a terrible calamity befell the leader of the monitors. The Tecumseh, standing straight for the Tennessee, was within 200 yards of her foe when a torpedo suddenly exploded beneath her. The monitor was about 500 yards from the Hartford, and from the maintop Farragut, looking at her, saw her reel violently from side to side, lurch heavily over, and go down head foremost, her screw revolving wildly in the air as she disappeared. Captain Craven, one of the gentlest and bravest of men, was in the pilot-house with the pilot at the time. As she sank, both rushed to the narrow door, but there was time for only one to get out. Craven was ahead, but drew to one side, saying, "After you, pilot." As the pilot leaped through, the water rushed in, and Craven and all his crew, save two men, settled to the bottom in their iron coffin. None of the monitors were awed or daunted by the fate of their consort, but drew steadily onward. In the bigger monitors, the captains, like the crew, had remained within the iron walls. But on the two light crafts, the commanders had found themselves so harassed by their cramped quarters that they both stayed outside on the deck. As these two steamed steadily ahead, the men on the flagship saw Captain Stevens of the Winnebago pacing calmly from turret to turret on his unwieldy iron craft under the full fire of the fort. The captain of the Chickasaw, Perkins, was the youngest commander in the fleet, and as he passed the Hartford, he stood on top of the turret, waving his hat and dancing about in wildest excitement and delight. But for a moment the nerve of the commander of the Brooklyn failed him. The awful fate of the Tecumseh and the sight of a number of objects in the channel ahead, which seemed to be torpedoes, caused him to hesitate. He stopped his ship, and then backed water, making stern way to the Hartford, so as to stop her also. It was the crisis of the fight and the crisis of Farragut's career. The column was halted in a narrow channel, right under the fire of the forts. A few moments' delay and confusion, and the golden chance would have been passed, and the only question remaining would have been as to the magnitude of the disaster. Ahead lay terrible danger, but ahead lay also triumph. It might be that the first ship to go through would be sacrificed to the torpedoes. It might be that others would be sacrificed, but go through the fleet must. Farragut signaled to the Brooklyn to go ahead, but she still hesitated. Immediately, the admiral himself resolved to take the lead. Backing hard, he got clear of the Brooklyn, twisted his ship's prow short round, and then, going ahead fast, he dashed close under the Brooklyn's stern, straight at the line of buoys in the channel. As he thus went by the Brooklyn, a warning cry came from her that there were torpedoes ahead. "Damn the torpedoes!" shouted the admiral. "Go ahead, full speed!" And the Hartford and her consort steamed forward. As they passed between the buoys, the cases of the torpedoes were heard knocking against the bottom of the ship, but for some reason they failed to explode, and the Hartford went safely through the gates of Mobile Bay, passing the forts. Farragut's last and hardest battle was virtually won. After a delay which allowed the flagship to lead nearly a mile, the Brooklyn got her head round and came in, closely followed by all the other ships. The Tennessee strove to interfere with the wooden craft as they went in, but they passed, exchanging shots, and one of them striving to ram her, but inflicting only a glancing blow. The ship on the fighting side of the rear couple had been completely disabled by a shot through her boiler. As Farragut got into the bay, he gave orders to slip the gunboats, which were lashed to each of the Union ships of war, against the Confederate gunboats, one of which he had already disabled by his fire, so that she was run ashore and burnt. Jewett, the captain of the Metacomet, had been eagerly waiting this order, and had his men already standing at the hawsers, hatchet in hand. When the signal for the gunboats to chase was hoisted, the order to Jewett was given by word of mouth, and as his hearty "Aye, aye, sir," came in answer, the hatchets fell, the hawsers parted, and the Metacomet leaped forward in pursuit. A thick rain squall came up and rendered it impossible for the rear gunboats to know whither the Confederate flotilla had fled. When it cleared away, the watchers on the fleet saw that one of the two which were uninjured had slipped off to Fort Morgan, while the other, the Selma, was under the guns of the Metacomet, and was promptly carried by the latter. Meanwhile, the ships anchored in the bay, about 4 miles from Fort Morgan, and the crews were piped to breakfast. But almost as soon as it was begun, the lookouts reported that the great Confederate ironclad was steaming down to do battle, single-handed, with the Union fleet. She was commanded by Buchanan, a very gallant and able officer who had been on the Merrimack, and who trusted implicitly in his invulnerable sides, his heavy rifle guns, and his formidable iron beak. As the ram came on, with splendid courage, the ships got under way, while Farragut sent word to the monitors to attack the Tennessee at once. The fleet surgeon Palmer delivered these orders. In his diary he writes, "I came to the Chickasaw. Happy as my friend Perkins habitually is, I thought he would turn a somerset of joy when I told him, 'The Admiral wants you to go at once and fight the Tennessee.'" At the same time, the Admiral directed the wooden vessels to charge the ram, bow on, at full speed, as well as to attack her with their guns. The monitors were very slow, and the wooden vessels began the attack. The first to reach the hostile ironclad was the Monongahela, which struck her square amidships, and 5 minutes later the Lackawanna, going at full speed, delivered another heavy blow. Both the Union vessels fired such guns as would bear as they swung round, but the shots glanced harmlessly from the armor, and the blows of the ship produced no serious injury to the ram, although their own stems were crushed in several feet above and below the water line. The Hartford then struck the Tennessee, which met her bows on. The two antagonists scraped by, their port sides touching. As they rasped past, the Hartford's guns were discharged against the ram, their muzzles only half a dozen feet distant from her ironclad sides, but the shot made no impression. While the three ships were circling to repeat the charge, the Lackawanna ran square into the flagship, cutting the vessel down to within 2 feet of the water. For a moment the ship's company thought the vessel sinking, but almost as one man they cried, "Save the Admiral! Get the Admiral on board the Lackawanna!" But Farragut, leaping actively into the chains, saw that the ship was in no present danger, and ordered her again to be headed for the Tennessee. Meanwhile the monitors had come up, and the battle raged between them and the great ram. Like the rest of the Union fleet, they carried smooth bores, and their shot could not break through her iron plates, but by sustained and continuous hammering, her frame could be jarred and her timbers displaced. Two of the monitors had been more or less disabled already, but the third, the Chickasaw, was in fine trim, and Perkins got her into position under the stern of the Tennessee, just after the latter was struck by the Hartford, and there he stuck to the end, never over 50 yards distant, and keeping up a steady rapping of 11-inch shot upon the iron walls, which they could not penetrate, but which they racked and shattered. The Chickasaw fired 52 times at her antagonist, shooting away the exposed rudder chains and the smokestack, while the commander of the ram, Buchanan, was wounded by an iron splinter which broke his leg. Under the hammering, the Tennessee became helpless. She could not be steered, and was unable to bring a gun to bear, while many of the shutters of the ports were jammed. For 20 minutes she had not fired a shot. The wooden vessels were again bearing down to ram her, and she hoisted the white flag. Thus ended the Battle of Mobile Bay, Farragut's crowning victory. Less than 3 hours elapsed from the time that Fort Morgan fired its first gun to the moment when the Tennessee hauled down her flag. 335 men had been killed or wounded in the fleet, and one vessel, the Tecumseh, had gone down. But the Confederate flotilla was destroyed, the bay had been entered, and the forts around it were helpless to do anything further. One by one they surrendered, and the port of Mobile was thus sealed against blockade runners, so that the last source of communication between the Confederacy and the outside world was destroyed. Farragut had added to the annals of the Union the page which tells of the greatest sea fight in our history. End of Farragut at Mobile Bay by Theodore Roosevelt.
Lincoln, from Hero Tales from American History. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. Lincoln, written by Henry Cabot Lodge. O Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack, the prize we sought is won. The port is near, the bells I hear, the people all exulting, while follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But, O heart, 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 leave you not the little spot where on the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead. O Captain, my Captain, rise up and hear the bells, rise up, for you the flag is flung, for you the bugle trills, for you bouquets and ribboned wreaths, for you the shores a-crowding, for you they call, the swaying mass, their eager faces turning. O Captain, dear father, this arm I push beneath you, it is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer, his lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm, he has no pulse nor will. But the ship is anchored safe, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with silent tread, walk the spot the captain lies, fallen cold and dead. Walt Whitman. As Washington stands to the Revolution and the establishment of the government, so Lincoln stands as the hero of the mightier struggle by which our Union was saved. He was born in 1809. 10 years after Washington, his work done had been laid to rest at Mount Vernon. No great man ever came from beginnings which seemed to promise so little. Lincoln's family, for more than one generation, had been sinking instead of rising in the social scale. His father was one of those men who were found on the frontier in the early days of the Western movement, always changing from one place to another, and dropping a little lower at each remove. Abraham Lincoln was born into a family who were not only poor, but shiftless, and his early days were days of ignorance and poverty and hard work. Out of such inauspicious surroundings, he slowly and painfully lifted himself. He gave himself an education. He took part in an Indian war. He worked in the fields. He kept a country store. He read and studied, and at last he became a lawyer. Then he entered into the rough politics of the newly settled state. He grew to be a leader in his country and went to the legislature. The road was very rough, the struggle was very hard and very bitter, but the movement was always upward. At last he was elected to Congress and served one term in Washington as a Whig with credit, but without distinction. Then he went back to his law and his politics in Illinois. He had at last made his position. All that was now needed was an opportunity, and that came to him in the great anti-slavery struggle. Lincoln was not an early abolitionist. His training had been that of a regular party man, and as a member of a great political organization, but he was a lover of freedom and justice. Slavery, in its essence, was hateful to him, and when the conflict between slavery and freedom was fairly joined, his path was clear before him. He took up the anti-slavery cause in his own state, and made himself its champion against Douglas, the great leader of the Northern Democrats. He stumped Illinois in opposition to Douglas as a candidate for the Senate, debating the question which divided the country in every part of the state. He was beaten at the election, but, by the power and brilliancy of his speeches, his own reputation was made. Fighting the anti-slavery battle within constitutional lines, concentrating his whole force against the single point of the extension of slavery to the territories, he had made it clear that a new leader had arisen in the cause of freedom. From Illinois his reputation spread to the East, and soon after his great debate he delivered a speech in New York which attracted wide attention. At the Republican Convention of 1856, his name was one of those proposed for vice president. When 1860 came, he was a candidate for the first place on the national ticket. The leading candidate was William H. Seward of New York, the most conspicuous man of the country on the Republican side. But the convention, after a sharp struggle, selected Lincoln, and then the great political battle came at the polls. The Republicans were victorious, and as soon as the result of the voting was known, the South set to work to dissolve the Union. In February, Lincoln made his way to Washington, at the end coming secretly from Harrisburg to escape a threatened attempt at assassination, and on March 4, 1861, assumed the presidency. No public man, no great popular leader, ever faced a more terrible situation. The Union was breaking, the Southern states were seceding, treason was rampant in Washington, and the government was bankrupt. The country knew that Lincoln was a man of great capacity in debate, devoted to the cause of anti-slavery and to the maintenance of the Union, but what his ability was to deal with the awful conditions by which he was surrounded, no one knew. To follow him through the 4 years of civil war which ensued is, of course, impossible here. Suffice it to say that no greater, no more difficult task has ever been faced by any man in modern times, and no one ever met a fierce trial and conflict more successfully. Lincoln put to the front the question of the Union, and let the question of slavery drop at first into the background. He used every exertion to hold the border states by moderate measures, and in this way prevented the spread of the rebellion. For this moderation, the anti-slavery extremists in the North assailed him, but nothing shows more his far-sighted wisdom and strength of purpose than his action at this time. By his policy at the beginning of his administration, he held the border states and united the people of the North in defense of the Union. As the war went on, he went on too. He had never faltered in his feelings about slavery. He knew, better than anyone, that the successful dissolution of the Union by the slave power meant not only the destruction of an empire, but the victory of the forces of barbarism. But he also saw, what very few others at the moment could see, that if he was to win, he must carry his people with him, step by step. So when he had rallied them to the defense of the Union, and checked the spread of secession in the border states, in the autumn of 1862 he announced that he would issue a proclamation freeing the slaves. The extremists had doubted him in the beginning, the conservative and the timid doubted him now, but when the Emancipation Proclamation was issued on January 1, 1863, it was found that the people were with him in that, as they had been with him when he staked everything upon the maintenance of the Union. The war went on to victory, and in 1864 the people showed at the polls that they were with the president and re-elected him by overwhelming majorities. Victories in the field went hand in hand with success at the ballot box, and in the spring of 1865 all was over. On April 9, 1865, Lee surrendered at Appomattox, and 5 days later, on April 14, a miserable assassin crept into the box at the theater where the president was listening to a play and shot him. The blow to the country was terrible beyond words, for then men saw, in one bright flash, how great a man had fallen. Lincoln died a martyr to the cause to which he had given his life, and both life and death were heroic. The qualities which enabled him to do his great work are very clear now to all men. His courage and his wisdom, his keen perception and his almost prophetic foresight, enabled him to deal with all the problems of that distracted time as they arose around him. But he had some qualities, apart from those of the intellect, which were of equal importance to his people and to the work he had to do. His character, at once strong and gentle, gave confidence to everyone and dignity to his cause. He had an infinite patience and a humor that enabled him to turn aside many difficulties which could have been met in no other way. But most important of all was the fact that he personified a great sentiment, which ennobled and uplifted his people, and made them capable of the patriotism which fought the war and saved the Union. He carried his people with him, because he knew instinctively how they felt and what they wanted. He embodied, in his own person, all their highest ideals, and he never erred in his judgment. He is not only a great and commanding figure among the great statesmen and leaders of history, but he personifies also all the sadness and the pathos of the war, as well as its triumphs and its glories. No words that any one can use about Lincoln can, however, do him such justice as his own, and I will close this volume with two of Lincoln's speeches, which show what the war and all the great deeds of that time meant to him, and through which shines the great soul of the man himself. On November 19, 1863, he spoke as follows at the dedication of the National Cemetery on the battlefield of Gettysburg. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that this nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note or long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who have fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from the honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. On March 4, 1865, when he was inaugurated the second time, he made the following address. Fellow countrymen, at this second appearing to take the oath of presidential office, there is less occasion for an extended address than there was at the first. Then a statement, somewhat in detail, of a course to be pursued seemed proper. Now, at the expiration of 4 years, during which public declarations have been constantly called forth on every point and phase of the great contest which still absorbs the attention and engrosses the energies of the nation, little that is new could be presented. The progress of our arms, upon which all else chiefly depends, is as well known to the public as to myself, and it is, I trust, reasonably satisfactory and encouraging to all. With high hope for the future, no prediction in regard to it is ventured. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it, all sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it without war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. Both parties deprecated war, but one of them would make war rather than let it perish, and the war came. 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was, somehow, the cause of the war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union, even by war, while the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it. Neither party expected for the war the magnitude of the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with, or even before, the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph, a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered, that of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world because of offences, for it must needs be that offences come, but woe to that man by whom the offence cometh. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offences which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war, as the woe due to those by whom the offences come, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just, a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. End of Lincoln by Henry Cabot Lodge. End of Hero Tales from American History by Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply in-app only.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. at forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com apply.